academic recital. The last 3 years, I have done unusual music by unusual composers that most people hadn't heard of. And this year I decided to do unusual music by composers people have heard of. Whether you be a recital, an avid recital goer, or have never been to one, makes no difference. I have always tried to explain things as carefully as I can so that as you're listening to it, without going into too much detail, you can still understand and comprehend what is going on musically and get, I think, more enjoyment out of the piece. I picked six composers this evening of varying periods, starting with old Granddad Bach, and the works are all, well, with one exception, works of fairly well-known composers, but perhaps not the most famous works that these composers have ever written. I'd like to open this evening by doing a suite, one of the French suites that Johann Sebastian Bach composed. Just a few words about it. First off, it was not composed for the piano. We talked about this the other day in the piano lecture I did on Tuesday, or Monday, whenever it was, that the time of Bach, this instrument, of course, had not been invented. The only instrument they had was the harpsichord, was the basic concert keyboard instrument. The harpsichord sounds so completely different than the piano. It's starting to come back into vogue a little bit. The big difference being that with the piano, you have strings that are being struck by hammers, you know, if you've ever looked inside, whereas when you get to the harpsichord, you have little quills that pluck the strings. So it's an enormous difference in sound. It's the difference between a string being hit and a string being plucked. The touch was completely different on a harpsichord. And consequently, modern interpretation of Bach works on piano, there's a certain amount of freedom because you can't be really that authentic about the way you might want to do them sound-wise. With that as an introduction to the tone of the piece, the French suites are just that. When we speak of the word suite, we're thinking in terms of S-U-I-T-E rather than S-W-E-E-T. I leave nothing undiscovered. I figure, you know, we don't know how far we can go here, so someone might think, gee, that was a sweet piece he played, you know, and I don't want that to be coming along. A French suite is a group of pieces put together, a group of dances. The dances that are used were not dances that were danced at the time of Bach. They were danced several centuries before that, but the basic style that went into them is still kept in the music of Bach. So I want to get that point just so that you realize this is not music that people are going to get up and dance to. Not at all. But he used as a form from that. It's divided into six short movements. I think the easiest way to describe it, rather than the seven short movements, the easiest way is to take them in little segments rather than tell you what each of the seven movements are and then you're sitting there, now what did he say was the sixth? I'll tell you about the first couple and then we'll do that and then do the group of three and then the last group of three. The first two movements are what they call Allemande, A-L-L-E-M-A-N-D-E, and Courante, C-O-U-R-A-N-T-E. And the Allemande and Courante were always the opening movements of the suite. This is standard. There are six of these French suites. You look through them all and they're always the same. The Allemande is a moderate tempo kind of piece. You can tell the Allemande in several ways. One is that, and these things always come up, there's always a little pickup note. In other words, the piece does not start boom. There's always one little note right before the beat. And that's the way you can always tell in one way that you have an Allemande. And it's always in 4-4 time, you know, 1-2-3-4. So there's always one little pickup beat and then you start in. And it's, you can also tell it because it has a lot of flowing notes, that there isn't a great deal of just chording. It's a lot of moving notes in both parts. And then the second movement that follows it is the Courante, which is always in 3-4 time. It also has a little pickup beat, but it's always much, much faster. It was always kind of a little showpiece that was stuck in there, you know, and sort of take the breath of the audience away at that period of time when they were listening to the harpsichord. It isn't that fast, I mean, you know, it's not going to be. But it was that kind of movement, and it was a fast dance. So then let me do the first two movements of the French suite, and we'll talk about the others. For the fourth year, I have my very evil pig here. Yes. There's no sense changing a good thing. The patient, that is. Harpsichord, you can't control on a harpsichord when you play it out of the top. You have one volume and that's it. But you can control it by playing on one manual or the other manual can be loud or soft. There's various ways to work it out. Anyway, what they would do is play it once loud and then the repeat would be soft or, you know, variations of it, that kind of thing. So this was the way it often worked. But I'm not including the repeats this evening. The next movement is the Saraband. It's a very slow and very graceful dance with a lot of ornaments. Ornaments are little turns and trills and things like this that are added into the music. And after the Saraband comes a movement entitled the Bourré. The Bourré was, this is kind of interesting, there are two dances that come together at this point. It was a French, I'm sorry, not the Bourré, the Gavotte comes first. The Gavotte was divided, was came from the people of Gavotte, a region in France, and it was an unusual dance in that it was, you'll be able to feel this, and it was a dance where you had to lift your feet off the ground. Until this time in France, when they did this dance in the 14th century, they kind of, you know, excited, they kind of moved along like this. And this was the first dance that people actually lifted their feet off, and you can feel the lift off. It always has two upbeats. That is, if you're counting in 4-4 time, and you're going 1-2-3-4, the piece will always begin on the third beat, 3-4-1. You can always feel that up and one. It was a very common dance form. Immediately following it, sort of as a contrast, is the movement entitled the Bourré, which is much like the Gavotte that you heard, very light. It should be a little faster, the contrast, and the only difference is that it begins only with one note pickup, so that you go 4-1, and it's the same thing in 4, and it goes along about the same thing. So we have three movements then, the Saraband, the Gavotte, and the Bourré. For any of you who might be familiar with the Zwingli singers, who've done a lot of music of Bach and Mozart on recordings, you know, with boop-boop and singing in this way, the Gavotte is one of the ones that they have done, so you may recognize it from there.
after this, the last two movements of this particular suite, the luray and the jig. The luray was taken from an old bagpipe dance. The word luray actually comes from the word bagpipe. And it was used mainly in kind of rustic music, and it has kind of a bagpipe sound about it. It doesn't harmonically, you don't have all these things happening that you've been hearing in the other movements with hands going all over. It stays pretty much, because the bagpipe doesn't do much. I mean, if you've ever heard one or played one, you know, it's off, and it just sits there, and nothing will happen. And that's about the way it was with this little tune. You know, he sort of had to just sit. One hand doesn't do too much, it moves a little bit. But then the final movement is the jig. Jig is an old Italian word for violin, and actually it's very old, because I don't think any of us have been using it. It's actually from the 15th century, and it's a word that they used to refer to the violin, and it's a sprightly little dance. It's always the hardest movement. Bach was very nice about that, to make the hardest come at the end. And the reason it's so hard is that once your hands start, they never stop. It's a little fast little dance. It is in two sections, and just a word about the jig when you hear it so that you recognize a little something about music style. There's always a subject, and it comes in three times. You can't miss it. And then it comes in the left hand, and finally, and then it keeps weaving on back and forth and keeps going. Then after you've gotten it all through and you come to a rousing conclusion and that's done, then what was always the mark of a great composer is, could you take that subject and invert it? That means, can you use the same notes but change the placement of the notes? And use them again for the second section and make just as interesting a section. And of course what Bach does is simply turn them around in a new key and go. And it's the same thing, but you just change the notes all around so that you have. And then. So these two sections comprise the jig. So it's the luray and then the final movement, which is the jig. Thank you. there, we move up into music now that is all written for the piano. The next would be Mozart. This is just one movement from a sonata that he wrote. Sonata is a common word in piano music. Many of you may be or may not be familiar with the term. S-O-N-A-T-A. They're always in three movements up to modern times. And fast, slow, and fast is the usual way to operate things in that form. I'm going to do the first movement of the B-flat sonata. Mozart is an unusual composer in that he died at the age of 35, having composed over 600 works. He began composing at 3, or began playing at 3, excuse me, and composing at 4, and was proficient. He was what you would call, he was born with all of them, of a genius mental capacity. I mean, it was all done. He didn't have to grow. The only thing that had to grow was just his body. I mean, how else can you be composing and playing when you're 3 years old? I don't expect Timothy to be doing it another year. He does, I'll be kind of surprised. Anyway, by the time he was 5, he was touring Europe playing recitals. And, which isn't really too bad. And so that he composed, I mean, many of his works, I mean, quite early. He also had an extremely tragic life. It was not a happy life. He was always being exploited because he was so good, not only by his parents. His father had went all over Europe playing these things, and also by his wife when he married, and he had a very unfortunate life. It's amazing that with all of the happiness that comes out in his music, it's always amazing to see this, because his life was so full of misery that it was just, music was his way of having happiness, and he would simply lock his mind off from the troubles that he had when he composed his music. His operas, such as Marriage of Figaro, are absolutely masterpieces of writing, not only musically, but as far as humor, they're wonderful pieces, and it's amazing that during that time is a time that he was so many thousands of dollars in debt, he was supposed to be thrown into prison, all of this was happening, this was so common for him all of his life, and yet so much of his music, you find such a wonderful lightness and gaiety about it, it's amazing that he was able to write music of this kind. This is the first movement then for a work, the Sonata in B-flat. It was composed all in the middle part, I suppose he was maybe 27, 28 or something like that. And, no, it'd be about 25 when he was. And the work is just the first movement. It comes in three definite parts. And what we call your three main parts of the work. So your exposition, your development, and recapitulation. Recap is an easy way to remember that. And it's very easy because what you do at the beginning is you have what we call exposition. Two main themes. You'll hear them. There's one right at the beginning and a little later comes another one. Then comes development. Development means that they take these two themes and just do all kinds of things with them. The composer puts them in other keys, and there's quite a long series. And then comes the recap, the recapitulation, when all of this comes back together. And you can hear it because the recapitulation is just exactly that at the very beginning. And so when you hear that, you sort of go, oh yes, now we're coming to the close. Oftentimes people are thinking, oh, that's very nice, and how long did that last? And you know, if you have a little idea, perhaps a semblance, if you heard it a couple of times, you catch it very quickly. But there are the three main sections to listen for. This first movement of the Sonata in B-flat of Mozart. Mozart followed in that line that they were excellent pianists, and so consequently decided that everyone else who played had better measure up if they're going to tackle, especially in the later pieces. Thank you.
Thank you.
piece by the French composer, the modern French composer, Claude Debussy. It was actually, I think it was the last part of the 19th century that he was writing. You all know Claude Debussy for a piece which I will not play. This is on the same style, but Debussy was the start of a new era in piano music. We call it Impressionism. You probably call it mood music, but it's all one and the same. It was a retaliation against what was going on with great big fat romantic pieces. They wanted more of these kind of mood pieces. They sort of begin nowhere, as someone has said, and end nowhere, so you don't get anywhere in between. But that's not really true, because they are really very beautiful pieces. Debussy was the start of this French school. It has been very active up to the present day and has accounted for a great number of fine pieces in the piano repertoire and in the orchestral and many other fields also. One of the ways that composers like Debussy in this period wrote was that they would take something for inspiration, a poem, a picture, and then title it by that same name. This isn't always true, but it was true to a great extent at this period. This particular piece I'm going to play has a very common name. It's a ballad, the French ballade. And yet, to write a piece like this, so often they would read a poem of some nature to themselves several times or have it in front of them while they were working. And then using this particular poem, it would serve as sort of an inspiration for that particular mood that they were trying to create. I looked through some poems of that era and selected one that I think fits very well into this particular piece. It's by a composer who lived at the same time as Debussy, that's just a bit earlier, but a fellow who was very influential in the modern French school of poetry. And I don't know how much you people enjoy poetry. The French poetry for this kind of music, if you ever have any French music at home, if you have a book of poetry, it really makes it all the better. But I've selected a poem entitled Dawn, D-A-W-N, Dawn, by the Frenchman Arthur Rimbaud. And Rimbaud writes in language that speaks of dawn, of his awakening to discover dawn. I think it's a poem that would fit very well up here at Holden. When he speaks in this poem of things like the goddess, he's speaking of dawn, so that you don't think that there's some goddess out there he's trying to find. All these things are, all the alliteration that comes in, everything is going towards the idea that dawn is coming, or that dawn is here and he's trying to find it. And then after I have read this poem for you, I'll play the ballade of Debussy. I have clasped the summer dawn. Nothing moved as yet on the brow of the palaces. The water was dead. The camps of shadows did not leave the road in the wood. I walked, awakening warm and living breaths, and the precious stones watched, and the winds rose noiselessly. The first venture on the path already filled with cool, pale radiance was a flower who told me her name. I laughed at the blonde wasserfall disheveling its hair through the pine trees. On the silver summit, I recognized the goddess. Then one by one, I raised the veil. In the path, shaking my arms, on the plain where I denounced her to the rooster, in the great city, she fled among the belfries and the domes, and running like a beggar on the marble caves, I pursued her. At the top of the road near a laurel wood, I enclosed her with her clustering veils, and I felt her vast body a little. The dawn and the child fell at the foot of the wood. At the awakening, it was noon. Thank you.
If you look at a piece of music, it's written in a key, usually. Like it's in a C, or it's in an E, or it's in a key. Atonal music is not in any key. There is no key that it's in. I don't know how to describe it. Except that it's atonal. It has no tonal center. To a degree, it's a worked-out piece of music. It, to many people, lacks the expressive quality that you just heard in Debussy. I think there's expressive quality there, but then I'm biased because I like both sides. And there's something about this particular kind of music that one has to work with a while. It's 12 tones is a part of this whole atonal system. 12 tones is really a very simple term to understand. From the time you start on A and go up from the bottom of the scale, from the time you take any A or anywhere on the scale, and you go on up until you reach the next A, not counting it, there are 12 notes. If I start on this A, not counting that one, there are 12 tones or 12 notes. So what the 12 tone system does is that it's a very difficult system as far as composition goes. It has to be worked out very carefully. You are not allowed in that system to use, and you devise whatever series you want. You don't have to go up the scale. You might take A, and then maybe next take E, and then jump back and take C sharp, and then grab a G sharp. But the point is, you have to use each of the 12 tones before you can start using them over again. It's a rather mathematical kind of writing. There are variations in this. Some people don't use it as formally. There is formal and informal use of it, but we're not going to get into all this. Anyway, this piece is in three short movements. It's short, not because I picked a short piece in this style, but because the composer, Anton Webern, W-E-B-E-R-N, never wrote long pieces. He has a string quartet, one movement of which takes 35 seconds. He said, I can get said what I want in short order, and he did. And unfortunately, he did not live as long as one would have liked to have hoped. He was certainly a real master of the style, and I really have come to kind of appreciate his music. It's to a certain degree, it's scholarly music, in that you get more out of it. Well, this is true of anything else, but in this particular kind of music, I think you get more out of it once you get a chance to look it all over and go, oh, isn't that interesting? Yeah, I see how that works. This is true of Bach or anything else, but in this particular music, I think it's a little easier to grasp if you've had done a little homework on it. The only homework I can give you to tell you is that explain the three movements very quickly and then perform them right along.
The first movement is a very slow series which introduces one of these 12 tone series. He's very careful about using it. The series is, what you do is you take your music and figure it out then. I mean, the person's got to play, you've got to figure it out. He does it right now. This is my 12 tone series. You have to figure it out. By 12 tone, I don't mean that you have to go single. You can put a chord together, a four of them, you know, like, and go from there, so that you can use them in combinations of 1, 2, 3, you know, as many as you want. His series is... I won't ask you to hum it back, but that is the 12 tone series that he uses. And he is very careful to use just those 12 tones. Now, what happens? That's the right-hand part. And he uses, here are the 12 tones. First of all, you use the first two together. The first two, which were, are used as, you don't have to use them, you know, you can have one tone up here and the next one way down at the bottom of the piano. But the point is that you have to use a D, one D on the piano, I don't care where it is, but it's got to be used. And so you might use down here, but you use one of them. Anyway, you have this one. At the same time, in the left hand, what goes, is what we call retrograde. And that just means that you take this same series of notes, only start with the last one. And so the left hand works in that system and has a retrograde of your 12-tone system. I won't go into any more detail, I won't take care of it. The first movement then is in a very slow, ponderous thing. It's very, at the opening, it's very clean and precise. You can feel how it sort of moves. You can sort of hear how the 12 tones are building up. The middle section becomes a great compilation of all these tones, and it's kind of wild. And then the ending of the first movement again comes back, and you can hear this series come through quite well. The second movement is a short little scherzo. Scherzo is, this means a short, fast piece. It can't possibly take more than a minute. It's the hardest movement. It's the hardest 1 minute I've ever had to learn, because it goes all over the piano, and it's a very worked out thing, and the right hand may play, those of you who know music, it might say treble clef A, next note bass clef low E down here, next note treble clef G, you know, this kind of thing. So you're, you know, and the hands are crossing like crazy, and if you don't end up like this, that's what you want to do. Then the third movement is where the title of the work, which is called Variations, comes from, because he has taken the themes of the first two movements, which you will certainly remember, and taken these and put them together to compose the last movement, which is a series of variations. That's another 12-tone system, we're not going to do that. These then are the three short movements that comprise Anton Webern's variations. The only other thing I would say about his music, he loves to write his tones so that you get clashing tones like Variations of Anton Webern.
Thank you. Thank you.
rather interesting. I enjoy it. But it's a completely other side to the whole picture of where modern music is going. One is going one way and one is going the other. And I feel very strongly that any professional musician who expects to be active in the field has to know both sides of the picture to know just exactly what's happening. I'd like to end this little program this evening with a very standard work that probably everyone here knows, which is the A major Polonaise of Chopin. I will only say this piano has very hard action, and I'm going to skip the repeat because of it. Well, I might do a couple.